everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Keeping It Real. I'm your host, Emily. I'm here with my co-host, Bailey, and we're here to bring you another exciting episode featuring inspiring Métis stories from across our homeland. Today, we're bringing on our special guest, Zach, to talk about Métis self-governance. But before we get started, of course, I have to ask Bailey a random question. So, random question of the week is, if you could fly anywhere as soon as COVID was over, where would you go?
Ooh, a random question is a prerequisite for this podcast. We all know that. I think I really want to go to Iceland again. I was there briefly a year or two ago on a 24-hour layover. It was a beautiful country and I would love to get to explore it more. Emily, what about you?
Yeah, Iceland would be really cool. I've never even got that far in my dreams, but I would really like to go to New Zealand. I have had a trip planned before COVID, so I'm hoping I can go. So yeah, that's my hope. And then can we give a little bit of an introduction to who Zach is and why we decided to chat with him today?
Absolutely. So Zachary Davis is a senior associate with Pape Salter Taye LLP and specializes in Indigenous rights law with an emphasis on litigation and governments. He has been working for the M&A as legal counsel for 6 years, and he has a broad depth of knowledge regarding Métis self-governance, both contemporary and historically, and how it relates to things like the buffalo hunt and the provisional councils. He gives some really good advice to Métis youth who are looking to get into governance and who are looking to be a part of this self-governance process as we move forward with the Constitution.
Yeah, so we're really excited to talk to Zach today. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Have you been working a lot and everything? Or did you get some rest with COVID?
No, I've been working a lot. We stayed really busy. Yeah. I've been working from home and I have two little kids. So that's been a challenge.
Oh, yeah. Sure. That'd be hard to be a lawyer from home and have your kids like just want to hang out with them.
Yeah, like you want to hang out with them and they want to hang out with you and you end up just like aggressively ignoring them, which is no good for anybody. So what we did in the end is I have some family that lives in the neighborhood and we made a bubble and each adult just takes a day of the week. So really I lawyer 4 days a week and I was teaching grade 2 one day a week.
That's an awesome side gig. Well, to start us off, did you want to go ahead and give a brief introduction of yourself, like who you are and what you do?
I'd be happy to. I am a lawyer. I work with a firm based in Toronto called Pape Salter Taye that specializes in Indigenous law. We only have Indigenous clients. And in fact, we only work for Indigenous governments across the country, Inuit, Métis, and First Nations. I have been working with the MNA as legal counsel for them for about the past 6 years. And I find it to be tremendously interesting work. When I got into practicing law, you know, I thought to myself that Canada is a great country and Canada has a lot to offer the world, but there's always room for improvement. And the best starting point for improvement really is to kind of know thyself, look inside and examine your own neuroses. And when Canada looks inside itself, I mean, there's a lot of good things, but there's also some black spots. And I think it's obvious to everyone that's listening that one of the big black spots is Canada's relationship with its Indigenous people. So I got into this line of work. And ever since, for about the past 10 years, I have been working for and advising Indigenous governments so that they can better serve their citizens. And it's tremendously gratifying work.
Was there like a moment when you realized you really wanted to work with an Indigenous governments? Because that seems like a very, I don't know if niche is the right word, but like a very specific interest.
It is a little bit niche. It was more niche when I got into it, to be honest. Right. We're at a point now where no major development can take place in our country without there being engagement and consultation with Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And that's fantastic. But that's really new in Canadian history. You know, that comes out of a Supreme Court decision in the mid-2000s, which was made, I think, the year I got into law school. And so even in law school, it was, you know, a burgeoning and niche area. What got me interested in it actually is I had a friend, I grew up in Alberta, and I had a friend in Alberta who was Métis, and we were fishing in the early 2000s and got stopped. I'm not Métis. We got stopped by conservation officers and were asked for our fishing licenses, and I had one, and she didn't, and she showed her M&A card. And the conservation officer hummed and hawed and took it away and didn't know what to do and said that he would send her a ticket in the mail. And in the end, nothing came of that. But I took that as a question when I went to law school about, I mean, I thought that ought to be a settled issue. I just thought that Métis people, as Indigenous people, had harvesting rights. And it turned out that was a hugely complicated issue, one of these neuroses of our country that we're still grappling with.
Were you involved in the harvesting agreement that we made at all then? Like, was that kind of cool for you to watch come to be?
It was very cool for me to watch. I was legal counsel for the M&A in negotiating that. So I was at the table through that process. Our firm, before I was involved, had assisted the M&A in negotiating the previous harvesting agreement, the interim Métis harvesting agreement that was then canceled. Our firm then undertook litigation on behalf of the M&A to affirm harvesting rights. That again got complicated. It didn't quite go the way the M&A wanted. And that led to kind of re-engaging in negotiations for the new harvesting agreement. And that's where I stepped in. And I think that it was very challenging. I think it's tremendously challenging to get provincial bureaucrats to understand the importance of these issues for the Métis and to see them from a Métis perspective. They either see them from the perspective of a non-Indigenous person where hunting is a privilege that is done, you know, if the Crown gives you permission to do it and otherwise can't be done, or they see it from a First Nations perspective where it's treaty right and that's well understood, and who First Nations people are that have treaty rights is very well understood. They're on a list. The federal government keeps the list. The bands keep the lists. So it's not complicated, and there's, you know, decades of court decisions about that. It was really hard for them to get to see it from a Métis perspective. There isn't a lot written about it, and no one learns about it in school. So it is as much a process of educating as it is of anything else.
Mm-hmm. So it kind of seems like everything is wrapped up in this idea of the Métis as, you know, their own governing entity within themselves, both contemporary and historically. Do you think you could talk a little bit too about the history of Métis self-governments from like maybe a more historical perspective regarding harvesting and the buffalo hunt and the governments that we've formed previously?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's a question that all Métis people in Alberta right now should be kind of asking themselves and exploring. It is really rewarding to explore. There's a lot to learn, but also there's a lot that isn't obvious. And I think that you can learn it probably as a Métis person better at home around the kitchen table with your parents and your grandparents and your uncles and aunts than you can in a library. That said, some things have been written about it and some things are known about how Métis govern themselves historically, and it's very interesting. I think, like a lot of Métis culture, what comes across strongly are features of both Indigenous traditions and European traditions. So, you know, one thing that I would qualify as a European kind of tradition that comes across in the history of Métis governance is codification. So one of the earliest examples we have, I think you mentioned them, were the laws of the hunt. And Métis hunts at this time were huge. You know, there were expeditions that would start out from places like Winnipeg or Pembina with 1,000 or thousands of individuals involved. Whole Métis families would go for the whole summer or for the winter. And there would be, you know, dozens of Red River carts. And it was a kind of quasi-militaristic way of organizing and pursuing gigantic herds of bison over vast territories, over the whole plains. And they had a very formalistic way of organizing themselves. At the beginning of each one of these expeditions, there would be an election where a captain of the hunt would be elected and then sub-captains would be elected. There was a codification of rules for how these hunts operated and a clear chain of command. So, you know, that's a feature I think that you don't see in a lot of other Indigenous traditions that might be reflective of European heritage. And that desire for codification shows up elsewhere too. You know, when Métis settle down on the prairies in places like St. Albert or St. Laurent, they develop and codify laws of the prairies. You know, Similar things were done when the provisional governments were formed in 1869 in the Red River and later in Batoche in 1885. Conversely, though, what's interesting is you see, and I think this is maybe more an indigenous feature of these governments, that they don't necessarily last a long time. They're very well organized. They're set up around a codified set of rules when the circumstances demand that they be. So when the buffalo hunts came to an end, when people made it back to the Red River, the governments that ran those hunts were dissolved. And there was no guarantee that the same person would be captain next year. That would, you know, be up to the next year's democratic process. And that person didn't have any of the authority that came from being captain once the hunt was over. Similarly, I think it's really interesting that the governments that were set up by Riel in 1869 and in 1885 were called provisional. They were provisional, and they were in response to crises that needed to be answered. And so there's this sense both of, I think, relatively strict organization, but of ephemerality and responsiveness to a situation. Métis people, you know, famously love to be free. They are the people that own themselves. And I think that they see the value of government, but they don't see a value in being overgoverned.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's the. Do you know how to pronounce the title of our magazine, Bailey?
Oxpamisowak.
Oh, yeah, Zach knows. There we go. Yeah, that's what I thought of when you said that. That's exactly what that means, right? Is the people who govern themselves. Mm-hmm. I think that's really cool. Did you want to talk too a little bit about like the role that script played in all that, and how, like maybe even like briefly, what is script and script fraud, and how did that influence Métis governance?
The history of script is fascinating. It's really unique to Métis people, and it is one of the features of Métis history and Canadian history that very few people know anything about. Métis people, in my experience, are aware of script, and almost every Métis person I met in Alberta has an ancestor that took script or was given script. People are less aware of what that meant, though, and the consequences of it and how this story played out. So I think it's important to tell. This all comes down to the days immediately following Confederation. When Canada was a young country, it was based in the east, upper and lower Canada, you know, Quebec and Ontario, and New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. But it had ambitions, and those ambitions looked west from the beginning. And so in the initial Canadian Constitution, 1869, there was a promise that the territory that was under charter to the Hudson's Bay Company, so Rupert's Land and the Northwestern Territories, could be transferred to Canada on terms to be negotiated. And then that would allow eventually for a link to be made so that British Columbia could join the Dominion. That was negotiated, and a promise was included in it that Canada would have to settle the claims of the Indigenous people living in the territory. And from the outset, it was acknowledged that there were two Indigenous peoples in this territory. There were First Nations and there were the Métis. And Canada set out immediately to address this issue with First Nations. They did it by negotiating the number of treaties. Those start in what is now southern Manitoba, and then they, you know, they stretch across all of the prairie provinces are covered by the number of treaties. That process did not immediately start with the Métis. This history starts in Manitoba, in what we call the postage stamp province of Manitoba. So, you know, you'll know that as a result of this transfer, and as a result of the Métis being rightfully nervous that Canada would not respect their land rights, which in the end, they didn't, Riel declares the first provisional government, and it's set up. And on the strength of that declaration, and on the strength of the support that he has from Métis people in the Red River, they negotiate terms of union with Canada. And those terms of union are set out in the Manitoba Act, which says that 1.4 million acres of land will go to the Métis children. And you have to understand that at the time, there were a lot of Métis children. I think, I always get the numbers a little confused, but I think there were 12,000 people in the Red River at the time, 10,000 were Métis, and 7,000 of them were children. There's an overwhelmingly Métis and young population. So securing land for their children was really important because that was going to give them the foothold in the new country to make sure that they could, you know, preserve their Métis identity and the identity of what would later become Manitoba. However, you know, Canada, in great Canadian fashion, rags the puck on the promise and doesn't deliver the 1.4 million acres of land in anything like a timely way. And in the end, doesn't even really deliver it as land. They come up with this way of executing this promise where they don't give land, they give coupons, another great Canadian tradition. And that's what SCRIP is. It's a coupon. It stands for subscription certificate, and it was meant to be redeemable for land. But it was in practice extremely difficult to redeem it for land. And in the end, what happened is a large percentage of the population, the Métis population in southern Manitoba, flees a reign of terror, and they either go into hiding or they move to Saskatchewan or Alberta. Some move to Northwest Ontario. And Métis claims just aren't addressed. They're still not addressed, and no action is taken to address them. And it's that lack of action coupled with a real influx of white Protestant Canadian immigration from Eastern Canada that puts tremendous pressure on Métis society. They see themselves losing their way of life. The buffalo are gone. They have no resources, and their land is being taken away from them. It's that pressure that leads to the Northwest Resistance and the provisional government in 1885. Resistance is put down by Canada. They do decide to address the Métis claim, and they do it again with SCRIP. Again, a coupon purportedly redeemable for land. But the process by which it could be redeemed was hectically complicated and involved kind of what would probably have amounted to years of traveling back and forth to Dominion lands offices, to post offices, mailing coupons into Ottawa, getting certificates in return, going to locate them, receiving letters patent. And in the end, it was set up so that Métis people wouldn't want to do it or wouldn't even get the land that they wanted. I mean, it's astonishing that, you know, a majority of SCRIP in Alberta was issued in northern Alberta, where there were a lot of Métis people living. But SCRIP was only redeemable for land that had been surveyed for settlement. And most of that was in southern Alberta. So if the Métis population wanted to get land for their SCRIP, they actually would have had to displace themselves, give up their homes around places like Slave Lake, and Lac La Biche, and move to Calgary or move to Medicine Hat. And Indigenous people isn't going to displace itself because you know, they want to obey the coupon redeeming process that has been set up by a colonial government. And, you know, Métis people didn't surprise. That's not what they did. What happened was there were land speculators who were financed in large part by Canada's big banks, but also by some private individuals, who followed the SCRIP commissions around. So the way SCRIP was issued is a commission would set up in a tent in a place where there were a lot of Métis people. You know, they set up in Edmonton, in St. Albert, in Slave Lake, in Peace River. They set up in Fort Chip. All the major Métis population centers, they set up there. And Métis people would come. They would go through these gigantic folders that they called elephant portfolios to see if the claimant had ever received SCRIP before and to ensure that they were entitled to it now. And if they were, they would be given the coupon that was eventually redeemable for SCRIP, eventually for land. And then they'd leave the tent and speculators would be set up and they would offer, you know, pennies on the dollar for the certificate. So a certificate would be for 160 acres or $160 or 240 acres or $240. And a speculator might pay $10 for it. They might pay $40 for it. So the Métis person would get 10 bucks or $40. They'd spend it on whatever. The speculators would go back and they would go through the whole arduous process and eventually get land for the SCRIP. The problem was that it was illegal for anyone except the person to whom the certificate had been issued to redeem it for land. And the white land speculators got around this by fraudulent impersonation. They would hire a Métis person to pretend that they were the person that got the SCRIP, or even a Métis looking person, a brown person, a First Nations person, just to pretend. And this is how the vast majority of SCRIP was located, was through this system of fraudulent impersonation. Miggy, though, have always been industrious, and they've never taken an injustice lying down. And, you know, this was no different. They started as early as the early 20th century petitioning the government for royal commissions to look into script fraud. The government ignored them. They said this was not a collective kind of claim. These claims would have to be investigated on a case-by-case basis. So then Métis from Wabasca actually brought a case against a well-known land speculator in Edmonton named Richard Secord. And he was remanded on several thousand dollars bail in 1921, which is serious money in 1921. And they, you know, they were going to go through with a trial for script fraud. And I don't know if I can say this on the podcast, but what happened at this point is the white powers that be lost their shit because they had all benefited from script fraud. I mean, I don't know that as a fact, but I strongly suspect that every one of the old, powerful, established families in Western Canada benefited from script fraud. And one of those families was the Lougheed family. Peter Lougheed, but first of all, his grandfather, James Lougheed, who was married to a Métis woman, actually. And he, at the time, in the 1920s, was a senator for Alberta in the federal Senate. Mm-hmm. And in response to this case, the Richard Secord case, they pushed through an amendment to Canada's criminal code, making it impossible to prosecute Métis script fraud. It is the only kind of land fraud that this exception applied to. All other kinds of land fraud could still be prosecuted. Fraud in relation to Métis script couldn't. And Métis script wasn't even the only kind of script. There was like Boer War script. You could prosecute fraud in relation to that kind of script. Métis script was the exception. So, I mean, I can hardly think of a better example of historic dishonorable conduct towards an Indigenous people than the history of Métis script to begin with, where I think 98%, if I was to pick a number, of the land went to white speculators and big banks and not to Indigenous people. And then in the end, the criminal code is amended so that no justice can be sought.
Does it still stand that way? I mean, like, I guess it doesn't matter anymore, but
I've looked. No, it's not in there anymore. I don't know when it was taken out. So, I'd be curious to look into a history of the amendment. But it's also full of racist language that, you know, thankfully haven't survived. It wasn't called Métis script. It was called half-breed script.
Yeah.
Or claims in relation to the half-breeds. And that's gone now. But, you know, any one of those claims could no longer be prosecuted for other reasons. So, but I'd love to know. I don't know when the amendment was taken.
That's crazy. That's like one of the biggest like frauds in Canadian history and no one knows about it.
That's literally the first time I've ever heard about this.
It is. It could easily be the biggest. I mean, if you count the numbered treaties as land fraud, there's an argument for that. Those are pretty big ones too. But this is something like 4 million acres across the prairies of Métis script that was subject to this fraudulent process.
Okay, but I was also always told that script had something to do with the Manitoba Act. So I didn't understand how it all. Yeah, I just didn't understand how those two correlated because I thought that script was like you got a piece of Manitoba.
It's both actually, and this is confusing to people. So the Manitoba Act sets aside that 1.4 million acres for the Métis children that I was talking about.
Yeah,
and that's implemented eventually through script in Manitoba, but okay. Then the Dominion Lands Act, which was the act that allowed Canada to extend its, you know, jurisdiction over land to the other prairie provinces,
mm-hmm.
provided for script as well.
Oh, okay.
Because there's also script in like was there script in the U.S. as well that was given out? But it was like
I don't think so. That.
Okay. So then I guess pivoting slightly to a more contemporary view of Métis governance, can you maybe give a brief elevator speech, I guess, about what the current self-government agreement is and what it means for people within the Métis Nation of Alberta who might not have a understanding of what that means?
Sure. The current self-government agreement is very interesting and it's unique, which I think is good. I think that it is an appropriate exception to the way that Canada has negotiated self-government with Indigenous people in the past because it is tailored to the needs of the Métis. So Canada in the past, in this kind of background, I think is important to understand what is so unique about the current self-government agreement. Canada in the past negotiated with Indigenous people, by which they really meant First Nations, to settle their claims to their territory through the comprehensive claims policy and to permit them a measure of self-government through the inherent rights policy. But Métis were never allowed to pursue negotiations with Canada under either policy in any kind of meaningful way. Métis tried, and it, you know, the door wasn't open for them. That changed about 5 years ago, and the MNA, along with other Métis governments, the Métis Nation of Ontario, the Métis Nation of Saskatchewan in particular, began meaningful negotiations towards self-government with Canada. The challenge the Métis face, though, is unique. The challenge is not at all like the First Nations challenge. Colonialism attempted to govern First Nations to death. It attempted to smother them in colonial regulation, and the principal tool for that was the Indian Act, breaking up traditional structures of government, imposing, you know, colonial structures of government that imported sexism, that imported values that were foreign to First Nations, and really distorting their self-image. And so the great challenge that First Nations face is escaping the Indian Act. The Métis were undergoverned. And this is a big story of the fallout of SCRIP. After SCRIP happens, the government of Canada takes the position that it has no continuing responsibility for Métis. And every province in the country, with the exception of Alberta, actually, and there's the unique story of the Métis settlements, but with the exception of Alberta, every province in the country takes the same position. They have no special responsibility for the Métis. So the Métis were left to fend for themselves and to organize themselves. And in some respects, this was really good because it allowed the tradition of Métis government to survive in a more or less unadulterated way. And that is the roots of the MNA. Right? The MNA builds out of organizations that start to form in the late 1920s in Alberta and really carry on that democratic tradition of self-organization and advocacy for Métis rights and interests that we see in the days when I was talking about, you know, the petitions in response to SCRIP. And the MNA survives for decades without becoming any kind of formal organization. It survives until the 1960s. As, you know, a truly Indigenous organization that has never been incorporated. But in the 1960s, with the revival of the Indigenous rights movement, Native rights movement, they called it then, organizations like the MNA incorporate so that they can receive funding from outside sources, from provincial and federal governments. And, you know, that was enabling, but it also was restricting. A nonprofit incorporation is not the best legal vehicle to be a government for an Indigenous people. And it has allowed other governments, federal, municipal, provincial, to cast the MNA and governments like it in Saskatchewan, in Ontario, as special interest groups, like any other nonprofit organization, and not as, you know, proper Indigenous governments. So that is the challenge that the MNA faces. Instead of getting out of the Indian Act, the MNA needs to get out of the Societies Act. They need to get out of being a nonprofit corporation from a legal perspective and become a proper Indigenous government. This is what the self-government agreement, which is officially called the Métis Government Recognition and Self-Government Agreement with Canada, does. It provides an avenue for the MNA to get out of the Societies Act. And it does it by doing two things, by offering, first of all, upfront recognition. It recognizes that the Métis Nation within Alberta has an inherent constitutionally protected right to self-government and is represented by the Métis Nation of Alberta, the MNA. And then it sets out a list of things the MNA can do. And if it does those things, will be recast in Canadian legislation as a government, not as a nonprofit society. And the key thing is to develop a constitution. When the MNA develops a constitution that defines the basic elements of government, who your citizens are, how you will make laws, how you will implement laws, and how you will resolve disputes about your own laws, then by operation of Canadian legislation, the MNA will cease to be a nonprofit organization and will be recognized as another order of government in the Canadian Federation. which will be hugely impactful for the work that the M&A does for its citizens, because it will be able to engage with industry, engage with the province, engage with the feds, truly an equal footing, a nation-to-nation, government-to-government footing, and not from, you know, the position of being seen by outsiders as something less, as a special interest group.
So, like, what is the M&A's different than the other Métis governments then? Does it have something to do with the Societies Act, or what's specifically different about ours?
There are three of these. So there are five members of the Métis National Council. Three of those members signed agreements like this, and they're all pretty similar. They're a little bit different because the legal standing of the Métis governments is different in each province, but it's not that different. From the province's perspective, it's fair to say that the Métis governments are non-profit societies in each of the three provinces where agreements have been signed: Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario. In each of those provinces have been challenges. Ontario has its own special legislation tailored to the Métis Nation of Ontario, and Saskatchewan has legislation for the Métis Nation of Saskatchewan. There's nothing like that in Alberta. So Alberta, you know, among the Métis governments from a provincial legislative perspective, is the one that is most considered just to be a nonprofit society. From the Métis perspective, it is, like the other two, a standalone Indigenous government.
Yeah. And then what would, like, the idea of a constitution, what would that do for us as a nation? Like, what kind of things might change with the way that we work and the activity, not the activities, but the way that we're able to implement things?
Mm-hmm. So what a constitution does is it empowers you. Right now, what you can do is limited by what the Societies Act says a nonprofit society can do. A constitution will be your own framework that you make for yourselves. You'll be able to amend it for yourself to the extent that your own constitution permits that, and you as a nation will come up with what that process is. Mm-hmm. It will empower you to make laws, and it will empower you to come up with the process by which you make those laws. So what it really does is, so for example, a good comparison would be the Métis settlements. The Métis settlements have a measure of self-government on the settlements, but they are creatures of the Settlements Act. So they can't change the way that they operate in any kind of fundamental way, or they can't change their definition of who their members are in any fundamental way on their own. They need the legislature of Alberta to do that for them. They need the provincial government to do that for them, because they are, in essence, like municipalities. They're creatures of the province. Mm-hmm. When you have your own constitution, you will be a creature of yourself. You will be Otpemisiwak. You will own yourselves.
That's cool. And then what about, like, with the land agreements? Because I know, too, with, like, the settlements, if they want to build things, sometimes they have to, like, go through the government. Like, does it have anything to do with our access to land and our, like, we have Métis Crossing? Will it affect that at all, or?
Initially, the Constitution will empower you to make laws about three categories of things: who your citizens are, how you operate yourself, and how you, you know, pick your own leadership. Negotiations are ongoing with Canada and will need to be ongoing with the province to see how that jurisdiction extends to things like land. Because obviously there is Métis Crossing. There are also offices that the MA owns in every region. There's other lands that the M&A is interested in acquiring. There can be no reconciliation without recognition of a measure of jurisdiction over land, even if it's, you know, just in relation to the exercise of Aboriginal rights, you know, recognition of the authority of the M&A in relation to harvesting and how harvesting rights are exercised. The strategic choice that the M&A made was, instead of trying to negotiate everything, the whole book, and I mean, some modern treaties are really the size of books. They're the size of phone books. Instead of trying to do that, the M&A made a practical choice. I think it was the right choice to get an agreement that acknowledges its core jurisdiction, its existence as a government, and then negotiate those other crucial issues from a position of strength.
Yeah. I feel like that does kind of make sense. Like, instead of jumping the whole river, like, obviously just take a little bit of a step at first. Cause yeah, as I asked that question, I was like, I guess you got to start small. You can't just like all of a sudden have self-government to the full extent. Right. So what will some, like, I know we were supposed to have our AGA this year, and that's where we were supposed to have our first conversations of what that constitution looks like. So do you know anything about the process of how that was going to go down?
I think the process is in development. There is a commission that has been struck. And so there are some knowledgeable and experienced Métis individuals from across the province have been called together in a commission. Their work, like everything else, has been affected by COVID. But they're, you know, working on not only producing, you know, drafts of what some of the elements might be, but also really working out what the process might be. Because there's some obvious questions that I think the MNA has answers to. You know who your citizens are. You know, there's a national definition of who is Métis. You have an outstanding registry that implements that definition. You know, are making progress on that every day, and there's no debate from the MNA's perspective about who ought to be entitled to be a citizen and who isn't. On the other hand, there's some questions I think that there needs to be a real discussion about. And, you know, I, as your lawyer from Toronto, certainly don't have those answers, right? How do you make a law? I think that we can draw on some of the historic governance traditions that we were talking about earlier, but things are obviously different, right? Making a law is not going to happen in the same way now as it happened during the buffalo hunts, where people gathered together and, you know, voted in a show of hands. There's going to need to be mechanisms that reflect that history, that reflect, I hope, that tradition of governing in response to real needs and not over-governing. But at the same time, they're going to have to reflect, you know, the modern way of doing things. The fact that there are other levels of government now that really affect people's lives that didn't exist before when those traditions were initially developed.
I think that we should go back to the buffalo. Yeah.
I think that we will need to find buffalo.
There's some buffalo farms by Elk Point.
There are farms, it's true.
The farmer's fields.
Yeah. And I hear actually that you're getting herds of bison at Métis Crossing, which I think is really cool.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That is cool. Why do you know more than me in Toronto? What's happening?
You know, I am in Toronto, but that doesn't matter anymore. Like, that used to matter when I had to travel to Alberta, but now everyone's just in their bedroom anyway.
I'm pretty sure they've told us that multiple times, Emily, so that might be a problem.
It's very plausible.
Maybe it was just me. I don't know. So I guess just pivoting a little bit, the youth, because, like, obviously we're with the youth department and we're trying to figure out what our next steps are in terms of getting our youth council incorporated. And I assume that is just going to be a discussion that comes with these constitution talks. Do you have any ideas about how youth can get involved, how the youth council can be a part of these discussions or can get, you know, their foot in the door to be a part of this whole movement that's happening now?
I think that it's crucial that the youth be involved. You know, when Indigenous governments are transformed through the process of self-government negotiation, the history of the negotiations and the history of the process is just as important or more important than the paperwork that comes out of it. There will be questions later on about what a certain provision means, what was intended. And those questions may not come up immediately. They might come up in a generation. And you see this with those treaties that really are now a generation old, like in Northern Quebec, the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement. And some of the strongest leaders the Cree have now are those individuals that were flies on the wall when the treaty was being negotiated. They were witnesses. And that tradition of witnessing brings a continuity that can really give an Indigenous government strength. So I think, you know, those Métis youth that are interested enough to be involved in the Youth Council have a really important role in contributing, but also in witnessing this, because in a generation from now, they are the people that will need to carry this tradition on, and they're going to need to know where it comes from in order to do it well. In terms of the actual mechanisms, you know, I would encourage them to engage with the MNA, because, you know, I don't have any special insight now as to to what this process is going to be. The commission will be reaching out. There will be initiatives like the AGA. You know, obviously, we're trying to figure out how to do that in times of COVID. You know, the immediate Métis response to something like this is, let's have a big get-together. Uniquely now, we can't have a big get-together. So we're working on new ways of doing it.
That is a unique challenge. It's funny. Yeah. No, but I think that's cool. And I was thinking about that, like, when I was watching it being signed, because it was live or whatever. And I was like, isn't that crazy that I'm alive when this is happening? And like, at some point, hopefully this is going to be taught in like history textbooks and someone can come up to me and be like, oh yeah, I was actually working for the M&A. Like, that was a really big thing. And like, I don't know. I just think it's cool. And like, I think that's huge about why youth should be involved, is because eventually we are going to be the voice of this agreement. We are going to be the people who have to be like, this is what happened. And these were the things that were said, and this is what it means, and all that kind of stuff, and translate it to the next generation to continue that. And so, yeah, I definitely think that like youth involvement in this process is for sure important. And then I think like our youth, like they make an impact. So I'm really excited to see what the Youth Council does with this.
Yeah, I think it's hugely important that this be an intergenerational initiative, right? Mm-hmm. There need to be elders around the table so that when an issue of, you know, how do you structure the new government to reflect tradition comes up, you have a voice that can reflect that tradition. You need that insight, right? Textbooks are not a good place to learn about what Indigenous government was like, because Indigenous government happens all the time. It happens around kitchen tables. It happens in the Saskatoon berry patch. And, you know, drawing on examples like that can be hard, but really rewarding. And, you know, so that voice needs to be there. And likewise, the youth need to be there. They need to be there because it's your job to figure out how to translate that, right? How that applies in the future, and to remember where these processes that you will develop as a nation in Alberta came from.
Yeah, even historically, like, youth were leaders back in the day when we're talking about historical self-governance, like Malcolm Norris, Louis Riel, Cuthbert Grant were all kind of in their 20s when they first got involved in the governing process. So it's not unheard of for Métis youth to be kind of on the front lines of making change, I guess.
No, I think that's an excellent point. That's absolutely right. All those great heroes of your past were in their 20s. Yeah. You know, they were kind of young, reckless, capable visionaries.
I also wanted to know, like, a little bit away from the youth thing, but like, what does this have to do on a national level? Does it have anything to do on a national level, like about uniting? Like, I know one of our biggest thing is like our cards aren't all the same, and like you can't have an M&A card that's recognized in Manitoba or something. Like, will eventually that all link up? Is that the goal, or is it to keep it provincial?
Métis governments will be recognized on a provincial scale. What that does to the way the Métis Nation proper organizes itself on the national level really remains to be seen. You know, the Métis Nation came out of a, you know, particular set of circumstances in the 1980s that required advocacy specific to Métis people. And now, decades later, you know, 40 years later, once you are recognized as a government, those circumstances are going to be radically different. Obviously, you're going to want to maintain a relationship with the Métis Nation across the homeland. But I think it would be naive to think that the nature of that relationship wouldn't change, right?
Yeah.
You know, what that looks like is another really interesting question. I will say that the relationship between the three Métis governments that are on this path, the MNO, the MNS, the MNA, has really flourished since the signing of the agreements. You know, they see each other's ambition, they understand it, they're helping each other, and, you know, there are challenges with some other governing members, but I think those are just sort of the natural growing pains that come actually with successfully advocating for respect for your self-government.
Even as our generation comes up, like, we're working with leaders in Saskatchewan, we're working with leaders in Ontario. And I think that unity is like, as we continue to like move forward with the growth in the next generations, I think we'll see more unity and stuff like that. But who knows? I guess you can never predict the future.
The Métis Nation across the homeland is like one big family. Yeah. Every time I've been at a Métis gallery, by kind of counting down the line, everyone can figure out how they're related to everybody. And in every family, there are fights. This family isn't any different, but you've held together now for 200 years. You'll still hold together in some way or another.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a good place to end it. Zach, thank you so much for coming on and joining us for this, you know, past hour. We really appreciate it. And we think the youth will be really interested in what you have to say. And it's a super interesting history that I don't think is necessarily widely known, especially outside of Métis circles. So we really appreciate that. Do you have any final words or advice for youth before we end it?
First of all, it was a real pleasure. This was, you know, a much better way to spend an hour than doing real work. So we can do it anytime. In terms of advice for the youth, I would say call your grandmother.
That's great advice.
Yeah, you should.
Well, thank you so much, Zach. We really appreciate it. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Keeping It Real.
We hope you enjoyed our conversation today. We want to give a huge shout out and thank you to Noah Smith for helping us produce and edit this podcast.
Catch you next week on Métis Monday.